Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear. Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. Today is Lonnie Clark. Oh man, is my brain scrambled? today is April 17, 2017. You're with Lonnie Clark, the Age of Vision radio show. It's April 17th and I'm a tax preparer, so that'll tell you why my brain scrambled. So anyways, thank you for joining us. I am super excited to have with us a new guest that I finally got her on. I've finally been able to connect with her. Ms. Jana Thrift from Eugene, Oregon. She's the Occupy Eugene videographer who has helped me on several occasions produce fabulous artwork. Besides being a videographer, she's really a true role model on what it means to be an activist and a true human being, a compassionate person. Her take on things often leaves me feeling like I have a lot more to learn. Let me put it to you that way. So welcome, Jana. Thank you for joining us. I truly appreciate you being here.
Well, that's a very kind thing for you to say, but I honor and respect everything you do as well, Lonnie. So thank you for having me.
Well, look, I asked you to be on here because you are a role model for activists. I mean, and it's not like you've had a life of luxury. You know, we run into activists all the time who have gotten into activism because they don't really have a lot of things to do and they're trying to look for something. But you have more than a full plate. You have lots of kids. You have a husband. You have property you're building up. And yet you still find time to make time in your life for really being there for lots of people in Eugene. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about your activism and how you got into it, and then we can talk about the things that I wanted to talk to you about.
Well, I was raised a kid in Oregon on the coast and with people who were very conscious about what was not going particularly right in the world. There was always a lot of talk in my life from a very young age, you know, about the problems that I think most people recognize. There's some pretty serious problems, and they've been evolving since I was pretty young. I'm about 45 now. And so when I was 17, I got a degree as a paralegal. I thought I would try to become a representative because I felt like my culture, you know, the lower class, poor people culture wasn't very represented. And I got scared off pretty young in life, realizing that our system is pretty broken. And then I kind of came back around after having six kids and being incredibly busy going to college again later in life to try to figure out how to support my very large family after my divorce. And so At about that time, I was looking into transportation. I thought, well, if you can't tackle the whole system, maybe you can just make one car run on something besides this polluting, destroy our planet kind of gasoline thing that we have going on. And
yeah.
So I went to school. I have a degree for automotive and diesel technology, and then I got involved with some different things. I went to fairs, learning about how different cars can work and all the great people working on doing something different in that world. And then Occupy came along, and I thought, man, if there's going to be a revolution, I'm going to show up for it. And so I went down to the park and really got involved. You know, it was really the first time I think I really felt like I was part of a real community, even in this town. And I lived here for 12 years before Occupy happened, but in Eugene for 12 years. I lived in Oregon till I was 12, and then I moved to Alaska for almost 20 years, and then I moved back here. And so I just, more than anything, you know, if I care about my family in the here and now, I'm there for them here and now. But if I care about their future, I have to take part of my time to invest that in caring about what happens for the future generations, my kids and everyone else's, you know?
Yeah. One of the things that is really amazing about you is you did not go away after Occupy pretty much got killed by Obama. I mean, they basically attacked it and made it go away. But here in Eugene, people were diligent, and it still meets on a monthly basis or a weekly basis, and you guys are still very active. But one, you know, and also you've been engaged with Rick Gold, who we interviewed on this show on KEPW from Eugene Peaceworks, where they got their first FM radio station. You're still actively engaged with that.
Oh, man, am I actively engaged with that. That is my focus these days. You know, the truth is that, you know, it's funny how you can make people disappear, similar to what we do with homeless populations in our country. You know, you can tell them, we don't want to see you, so please go hide in the woods, you know, where it's more dangerous for you, particularly if you're a woman, but it doesn't mean they don't exist, and I think Occupy is the same way. And I think Eugene is more prevalently outspoken in our occupiers. You know, we have an occupier on our city council now. That's how much work we've done post-Occupy.
Wow.
And post-Occupy,
who is that? I didn't know that.
Emily Semple. Emily Semple, her other name being Brave Beatrice. And Brave Beatrice was arrested at the federal building for the right to free speech. When they kicked Occupy off of the federal building, she was the one person who was arrested with the support of the Civil Liberties Defense Center and won the case with Lauren Reagan from the Defense Center defending her. She won the case that we are supposed to have the right to free speech, and it doesn't end at 11 p.m. It doesn't end when the authorities are tired of looking at you and say, we no longer want you to gather, because we're supposed to have the right to gather. And technically our Constitution still says that, even though we don't live by it much. You know, we're like, here, have a free speech zone. That will work. You know, go someplace in particular and call it free speech, which to me isn't free speech. But, yeah, so, I mean, the idea is that we really have been working hard. We meet once a month. It isn't a super well-attended meeting. Honestly, I think that what we really do is we've networked, we've created relationships, and we work hard in a lot of different directions that don't necessarily have the Occupy banner, but Occupy ignited a lot of people, and I'm one of them, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you've stayed ignited. I mean, that's the thing, is like you've actually gotten, you've dug in. I mean, and I have to say, you're quite a skillful videographer. Like, you've thrown together, I can't thank you enough for saving my conference the way it looked on video. You did the videography for the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference that we had with Mimi Gurman, Donna Gilmore, and Dr. Caldicott. So it's to your credit that you, it was very chaotic because of the technology the first half hour, and you saved it. It actually worked quite well. Thank you. We were talking, the reason I asked you to be on the show is because I wanted to get a diversity of ideas here, because this show, the title is called The Age of Fission. Now, and you know, you and I've had this conversation. You have houses and kids in Alaska. I'm freaked out about Fukushima. And what I've discovered over the last almost 2 years is it's not just Fukushima. It is everywhere. I mean, like everywhere. I don't believe that there's one square inch of the United States that is not probably a, got toxic slew all over it. Like with, if you just look at what the testing they did in the 50s, the map, the spray map of what they did with the 50s, the fallout map. So that being said, you know, you and I were talking about this diversity of tactics, because one of the things that we're both frustrated with, you work with Rick with KEPW. I had Rick on here, and we're trying to coordinate a way to get this show on your show. It's just I haven't had the time to even address it until after tax season is over. But it's about this diversity of tactics. Speak to that, because I'm very frustrated that we can't get water protectors on this show, because our water has tritium in it. Our water has low levels of uranium in it. I mean, it's not just chemical contaminants. It's not this, the threat from the oil companies. The thing that's in our water, we can't see it. We can't taste it. We can't smell it. But it is just as dangerous as if we're drinking a glass of black water.
Yeah, the water issues. Oh, I love, you know, the water is one of those things. I mean, I don't think anybody can say I don't have this connection to the water when how much of our body, like 90% of our body is water.
We're all water.
Yeah, exactly. And so when I say, oh, I have this connection to the water, I'm sure that I'm one of many, but I have a great love for the water. It's one of those things in my life that I really recognize as the healing element. and it's scary. I mean, if you really think about that, as far as the air that we're breathing and what, how it's in becoming part of our water, and the effect of nuclear radiation, both from Fukushima and all of the crazy things we've done for testing nuclear. I mean, if you think about it, they created iodized salt in the 50s to address the fact that they knew they were going to add radiation to our environment, and that they were trying to give us more iodine so that our thyroids were saturated better and not going to soak up the radioactive iodine from the environment as easily, right? I mean, so it, when they started doing that testing, they recognized that they were going to put this poison in the air, and they actually gave people table salt as part of the medicine to deal with it. Not that it completely works by any means, but it just, for me, it just is an example of how there was knowledge right from the start that this wasn't going to be good for people. How will we address it even before it's happened so much? And now we're really living 50 years post-fact with the ramifications increasing. And it's such an invisible poison that you don't know
the
it.
Deniability.
There's no accountability. You get cancer, and what do you say? Oh, I think it was Fukushima. You know, it's...
No, actually, you don't. You say, it couldn't possibly have been radioactivity. There's a lot of other things I've done to my diet. It's caused by everything else. This is the thing. It's not just the deniability. 50 years, you bring up an excellent, excellent point about them ionizing the salt, like giving us stuff to try to offset what they knew they were doing. That's not even discussed anymore, why that action was taken. It's also not discussed what they do with a lot of the radioactive waste, which is crush it up and put it, sell it as they dilute it with concrete and they sell it, or they dilute it with dirt and then they sell it, or they put it in illegally. They will dump it in public waste like they did in St. Louis. For years, they were allowing where this radioactive waste had been illegally dumped, That used to be a public dump, and people were allowed to come there and shovel it out and put it on their gardens.
Well, look at how they've done in Hanford. I mean, they put
Yes.
it into barrels they knew were not going to hold it for a long period of time. It's leaking into the Columbia River, and they know it.
And they're
And it's
lying
leaking
about that.
into
They're
the
saying
river.
it's not.
And they've admitted that they know that there's leakage and that it has made it that far. But it's like they downplay. I mean, it's not something you hear on the news regularly. You hear more about what's going on with your local famous person, and who they married or divorced in the papers more than you
It's the
hear about the
secrecy.
things that really need addressed, problems like the fact that the nuclear, like our infrastructure, we recognize the infrastructure is falling apart when we look at a broken road, but how many people think on a daily basis that the infrastructure of the nuclear facilities around the world are falling apart and they're not being cared for and paid for to do whatever is possible, which is not much when you're dealing with something as horrible that you can't even get close to it to deal with it. I don't know. It's
And then we have
very
senators who
overwhelming. I think
refuse
it's
proposals.
overwhelming for people, and I think it's why people turn their back on things that are overwhelming because it makes you emotionally distraught, and then you feel like you can't deal with
Okay.
other things. It
Okay, so
reminds me of
this is
the.
where I challenge people about this. This is what we have been taught to feel. These are like your first words out of your mouth. The first thing you said, I know it's scary. And frankly, I am very picky about words. I think our thoughts are things. They want us to feel afraid because that paralyzes us. I believe that what we
Exactly.
need to do is change the conversation and refuse to say it's scary. It is our reality and it is a challenge. It does not mean we cannot overcome it, and it doesn't mean we can't survive the diseases. And I'm not talking about going in and get prodded and poked by the American Medical Association and becoming an asset on their balance sheet. I'm talking about taking control of your own diet, believe in your well-being, create and change your diet. There are plenty of ways to heal yourself without all of their big pharma, hideous slave labor energy. That's what
It's
I
true.
and
It's
but I think
true.
it's very important for us to not to refrain from calling this scary, to saying, I don't know what we're going to do. I don't know how we're going to handle it. Oh my God, I just don't want, because it is, it's, this is my issue with, I have reached out to many water protectors and they say, yes, we want to come on. And then when they start talking about it, it's a very busy movement. I get it. They have a lot of activity going on, but I don't understand. This is my thing. Why they don't marry the idea that the water is just as contaminated from nuclear contamination. We have to marry them together because it's the same industry, the oil, the coal, and the nuclear. It's all, most of them are owned by the same people, just like our mainstream media.
Exactly. It's a situation where there are people that are seriously invested in these dirty energy kinds of industries, and because they're so seriously invested in that, they don't want to, it's like holding on to the past. Even when, it's like an abusive relationship. People stay in abusive relationships because they're scared of how hard it will be to move to the future. But the future's there. We have so many amazing options. It's clear that technology has created an amazing amount of options that we have to go towards. There's lots of things people can do. And I guess why I was mentioning, and I agree with you fully, and thank you for pointing out the idea that saying scary and overwhelming might make it feel scary and overwhelming, because giving those words to that, to that
Gives it
gives it
power.
more
It gives it
power in
exactly
some
what
way,
they
or
want.
disempowers you. And I think that the truth is that we definitely have daily choices. Like, we can choose on a daily basis to do something small for our own benefit. We can choose on a daily basis to do something small for the planet's benefit. And every one of those little things by every one of the people on the planet add up to something very big. And we can make very big changes that way. And I guess I was talking about people feeling overwhelmed because I want to recognize that more than anything. Just recognize that it can feel overwhelming, but that amazingly enough, if there's anything that Occupy showed me, watching this country evolve since just 5-6 years ago, is just the idea that all the little people doing little things, they change the conversation, they change the political environment, they make it so that it's these people that are invested in these big industries, if the people, if one, you know, people stand up and slowly join together one at a time in saying this is not what we want, it's like marketing, you know. If you if these companies realize that people aren't buying the product that isn't good for them, they'll quit making that and they'll make something better. It's the way it works, and anybody who runs a company understands that philosophy, right? And I think that's kind of how we can make these big changes, even when they seem so out of reach. And even when you feel like you're making these baby steps, I mean, in Occupy, we've been like, oh, is anything even being accomplished? And the day that Emily Semple took office, I thought, that is such big evidence that we are making an impact. People voted for her because they believe that she stood up for the people and the rights of the people and caring about people. You know, that's why they voted her in. And it was a big win for us. And more than anything, it was just an understanding that even though when we were out there canvassing and it felt like, you know, are we really making a difference here at all? And the next thing you know, she won by 116 votes, I think it was. It was like, wow, those houses I went to might have made a difference. It might have been the difference, you know.
It is actually. I canvassed here in Eugene for Rob Handy, who was a Democratic commissioner, who won the first time that a Democrat had won his area. And that's the Democratic Party told me is when I first moved here to Eugene, I was willing to canvass in areas of Eugene that other people thought was scary, because I'm from L.A. It didn't look at all scary to me. I'm like, yeah, no problem. I mean, there was a couple of houses that were obviously bad and you just skip them. You know what I mean? Like, you don't walk into, you know, these, there was one or two complexes that looked like they were full of crackheads, but whatever, you just walk away from those. But I don't know. It does actually really matter, Jenna. And this is the thing. All of our efforts matter. Like having somebody on the city council, I actually read that in San Diego, there were 6 Bernie-crats who made it to the city council and to a local elected official. So people are digging in. They are digging into our democracy. But let me tell you what the challenges that we have here. Maybe you can speak to this. Because the reason I'm going to keep coming back to the nuclear issue is I know you're very involved with Occupy. I know you're a big water protector. Your spiritual and religious beliefs are surrounding water. It is very important to you. In fact, I was at your wedding at the beach. It was really awesome. But this is what we are up against. There was a story I was going to mention, the missing bolts in the nuclear. When you said all of our nuclear power plants are falling apart, we have Indian Point, which is in the heart of New York City. Our elected officials there are keeping it open, because they say that New York can't do without the power. But in 2016, there was a story about the missing bolts. On Bloomberg News, this is how they frame it. Now, you tell me if people can quickly think of this. They say that they have found problems, inspectors found problems with the bolts. And what they're not saying is some of these bolts are missing, right? The agency's inspection of more than 2,000 bolts in the reactor's removable insert liner revealed the issue of about 11% and require more analysis. Each bolt holds holds plate inserts together inside the nuclear reactor. What they found is that there's like, and this is the way they twisted it. This means they have to replace many or all of the other 89%. That could become more costly because the 11%, you know how much 11% is Do people even under, can you just quickly do the math? That sounds like a small amount, right? Out of 2,000. You know how many bolts is missing? Or that I know for sure they, I think they have like 9 or 10 missing bolts. They just can't, they fell in. It's in too highly radioactive area. They can't go in and replace them. 220 bolts are in danger or faulty at this nuclear power facility.
Out of 2,000, which if you think about it, is not, that's a
11%
lot.
11% sounds per, small, a, right? But 220, when you're looking at a nuclear facility that has surround, and then I think there's 9 or 10 bolts that are just, or 18, some smaller number, much smaller number, something like that, that is actually just missing. And these other degraded ones, the ones that they are not exactly paying attention to, I mean, they're trying to get to them. But, you know, this is the frightening part about us, instead of bolstering up the EPA and Trump going, you know what, your organization needs to be cleaned out from top to bottom. We're going to make you work for the American people. They're going to shut it down and just let no holds bar on pollution. What do you think the nuclear industry is going to do to us?
I hate to imagine, just to be honest. I mean, it seems like that we're facing a period of time where people are okay with the idea of going forward with just about anything bad on the planet in trade for the dollar. So,
Jenna, this is a question I have. I have to ask you this, and I don't mean to give you a gotcha question, but this is really a very thoughtful question that I've had for a long time. About a year and a half ago, I did a protest out at the state capitol with Rick Gold, actually, and a few of his crew, and with Fast and Ricklin. We were protesting a commemoration, I think, of the Marshall Islands, the day they got bombed. It happened to be the very same day that a group of, an organization of homeless people came to the state capitol to assert their rights. Now, I had been given a few minutes. They had set up a speech, a stage, and asked me to speak. And I actually asked some of the homeless people to come speak, because homeless people are at greater risk of being exposed to radioactive contamination because of the acid rain, you know, the fallout that comes down with the rain. How do we get people to embrace the idea that the rain is actually highly radioactive post-Fukushima? Especially because Fukushima is not an accident that's been put out. It's still spewing radioactive contamination at untold amounts into the air.
Right.
So, you
how
know,
do
how
you get people to embrace that idea? Whew.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big question, because you work in the homeless community, you know, like you work to help benefit the homeless here. I know you do here in Eugene. You are at the Occupy movement. When I brought the issue of Fukushima to Occupy, everybody's eyes kind of rolled, and you know, that's kind of the attitude. Oh yeah, these anti-nukers, they're trying to scare everybody. That's actually what people say to me, is that I'm trying to scare everyone. I'm not attempting to scare anyone. I want us to act as adults and face a poison that is being spewed out daily, and that we have to deal with, like you said, like they started giving us ionizing radiation, ionized salt, to deal with what they knew they were doing with us. That's, and exactly. they also radiate all of our food. Anything you buy in a grocery store gets slightly radiated.
Yeah. To get rid of, isn't that partially to get rid of the things that they've done to the food by not growing it and processing it in a clean manner? So they let it go through some things in the factories that aren't necessarily good for it, and then they do that to kill the germs that they've created by not having a clean space where they're processing your food to begin with. Am I not mistaken about that? That's
correct, right? Yes.
I thought that's how I remembered that story. It's interesting, because it's interesting when you say that about people's saying that you are trying to scare them. I think it's interesting how there's always this external direction that people kind of try to go with things when it scares them, you know? And I think it's like, they don't want to say, this scares me. They want to say, you are scaring me. You know what I mean? And I think it really is people processing that fear and trying to figure out where to lay it. And the thing about nuclear is, or nuclear, I'm sorry, I try to pronounce it correct because it makes me seem like I don't know what I'm talking about. I had somebody tell me, you know, that's not how that word's pronounced, right? Nuclear is scary, and it's invisible, and it's not something that people feel like they have the power to do something about. And so I think that it's a situation where you kind of have to find the solutions and present people with as many solutions as you can, and that is the best way to have people acknowledge the problem.
See,
maybe.
I don't want them to just acknowledge it. I want people to lean into it. I want people to actively speak out against it, just like they're speaking
exactly.
out against the poisoning of the water. Like, and the fact is there are solutions, and part of the solutions are in your own personal life, but we do have solutions with the microbes. Charlotte has been on this show before and discussed, so has Chuck Heinemann. I mean, Chuck Heinemann's invested a boatload of money to try to stock up on this microbes. Like, he sells them. He lives in Kansas, and he sells some of the best microbes in the country. We should be putting that on all of our farms. We need people to be lobbying our government, you know, at the state level. Maybe I'll pick that one up. You know what I mean? Like, this is a big issue because we have solutions and they're just waiting for it to get so catastrophically bad before they begin to address it. And I suggest that it's imperative that we all join together, like the water protectors, the people that are standing up for civil rights, the anti-nuke activists, the anti-coal people, you know, all these, like, but the issue is this, is like 350.org, I don't know about 350, but I can almost guarantee you the National Resource Defense Fund got $10 or $11 million. They refused to give me who gave them that contribution because they have that right. But shortly after they received either an $11 million or a $10 million contribution, they started working with the legislature in Illinois to keep two leaking nuclear power plants open. And they said, that's because we want to close down the coal plants in Illinois. That's more dangerous. I'm like, are you joking? That's actually not true.
Well, if you think about the danger between nuclear and coal, coal will hurt your lungs and you know, damage your... Nuclear will take out future generations, make it so you can't have babies, poison you... dead, you know, I think it's definitely, if you look at the possibilities, you know, I just want to go back to a couple things. One thing is the idea, when I say that to have people acknowledge it, I think for me, that's the first step. People have to acknowledge that this is serious, this is a problem, so that they can reach within themselves and figure out what they can do personally about it. And I think what is happening is people feel like it's invisible, it's not something that affects them immediately, they can't really put a finger on how the crisis affects them today. And we kind of live in a society where people are like scrambling to survive, and the things they deal with are the things they feel like are going to endanger them immediately. And I think it's part of the reason why nuclear is not as recognized, and then that's what needs to happen, this process of people recognizing it for what it is. It's very interesting because I had a conversation with my son who was talking about whether we should go to the beach or not, and I had to really converse with myself. I had to search my soul about how I felt about that, because the ocean is something that I am so connected with, and so it's one of my greatest loves in life, and I seriously made the decision that I would give up part of my life to have that relationship, that it was part of what I enjoy about my existence enough to be willing to die for it. And that is kind of where I'm at. But I was talking to him, and I was telling him about the things you said to me about your concerns, because I have family. And I said, you do realize that Alaska is first in line. You're closer. If dilution is the solution for pollution, you're not as diluted there as we are here, because this is where right. the tides go. They go from Japan to Alaska and back down to us. By the way, I don't believe dilution is the solution, but I just know that's one of those things that's said as a way to convince people that somehow if you're far enough away from something bad, it won't affect you. But I was telling my son, and he's like, well, we never go to the ocean in Alaska. And I said, but do you remember how the planet works? You know, that water chart as a small child, when you see that what happens is the water from the ocean evaporates into the air, turns into the clouds, rains back down on you. And like any place that you're at that is at risk or more at risk, even if you don't go to the ocean, you're going to, it's creating your atmosphere. That's
okay,
what
so
the ocean
this is the
does.
Challenge. He's living in Alaska, right?
Yes.
So suggest to him that we've been 5 years in. We know, like in Ohio, there's a gentleman who goes by the name of Organic Slant. I think he even has his own website, organicslant.com, and he posts up mutations from his vegetable, from his garden. He has beautiful flowers and a vegetable garden, and we're 5 years in, and we are getting many flower mutations now. Petals that should have 5 petals have 8 or 9, or a stem will grow out of itself. There's all different kinds of mutations. You'll get 2 stems out of the base of a plant. The plant leaves, some plants are white instead of green. They look opaque yellow, you know how people get white dots in Fukushima? The animals are getting white dots. That's what happens. The animals get white spots. These plants are getting that. So suggest that you look around in nature. When he goes out looking, look in his own garden, because you can find them in the flowers. The birds disappear without our notice. The birds get mutated without our notice because they don't let us come up to them. You have to really search them out. But the plants are being mutated, and they are around. And I guarantee you that you don't have to keep talking to him about it. Just suggest that he start noticing, take a look closer at the flowers and at the plants to see if he sees any mutations, like the shape of the leaves will grow odd. Every plant is different, and even on the same plant, you'll have different mutations. This is how genetic DNA mutations work. And this is what I suggest to all of my listeners, wherever you're at in the country, you want to know how, because it's going to get to the plant life before it gets to us. And it's coming. This is the idea, is like, we got to figure out solutions and to protect ourselves from the onslaught of this fission before it gets to us at such a great level. But there are things we can do now, but we can start looking for we know that Matt Holstrunk, who has been on our show, he watches the radiation spikes. He captured some photos that posted on Facebook of mutated dandelions. Instead of being round circular, they were like long. And then there was another set that he had where there was 2 dandelions, 2 straight pistils, like growing out separately, where one should have been growing, where it one split off. It grew an extra stem. It was weird looking. But it's not the kind of thing you notice unless you're out kind of looking around going, huh, I wonder if there's anything out there.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about that is the typical person in the woods that sees something unusual recognizes it as something unusual, but they don't recognize it as, huh, is this the DNA structure of plant life changing because of radioactivity in our environment?
Yeah.
You know, it's normally they look at it and they're like, wow, isn't that cool? It's shaped different. You know?
Yeah.
It's very interesting. All these things, I just never ever talk about this without thinking about the first time I ever went to an informational hearing about Hanford. The nuclear reactor that we have very, very close to us that really affects us as Oregonians. I mean, it's barely over the border into Washington there, and it affects the Columbia River in a huge way, which of course, affects all of Northern Oregon. And then it runs into our ocean, which, you know, everything we have is interconnected. So anyway, I went to that meeting, and they had all these amazing scientists and people talking. I went on a Veterans for Peace bus, and everybody was talking about all of these technical things that, honestly, at the time, I had barely moved here. I've been raising my children, and that had been my main focus for quite a long time, and I had just gotten really involved with learning about what was going on in my environment. I mean, I moved down here, and I got a letter in the mail that said the water in my neighborhood was contaminated, the groundwater was contaminated. And everybody's like, well, we drink city water, so it doesn't matter. And I'm like, but my kid's playing in that puddle over there, and I live in Oregon, and I know that the groundwater is at the surface. I mean, that's kind of scary. And so that was kind of my first moment of thinking, why isn't the entire neighborhood up in arms? How can we be okay with this? And in Alaska, you hear about pollution, but it's the last frontier. We're 30 years behind the rest of the country. You don't, where they do all their oil exploration, but anyway, where they do all their oil exploration, they pay people so much money and they put them way far away. Nobody sees that. So there's nothing in your face. And so when I moved to Oregon, I was like devastated, honestly, about how much was in my face and realizing pollution isn't a concept. This is something that affects my daily life. When I get a letter that says where I live, the groundwater is contaminated. Anyway, so I was on this bus with Veterans of Peace and listening to these scientists talk about money, really. They're talking about why, because of money, we should do these things that could damage our planet and even our universe for thousands of years. I mean, an unbelievable amount of time to come. And I just listened to everybody, and I ended up going up there, and I said what I always still think, which is, with all of the amazing minds in this room, you know, with all the incredible people here that know so much about all the incredible technology we have at our fingertips in this day and age, can we not come up with a better idea than this? You know, it's, and because they're wanting to reopen Hanford to store more waste, when they basically have a crisis on their hand with what they've done trying to deal with figuring out how to care for the waste that they already have there.
Yeah, but
and then when you talk to people in Washington, they think it's all been taken care of. They're like, oh, we voted for them to clean that up forever ago. And they don't even know that they've been fighting it in court, that they have a constitutional right not to clean up the nuclear waste that is seeping towards and now has actually arrived at the river. It's like, I don't know, but I know that we have the technologies to do something different. It's the process of the people pressuring those that have control of the industries to do the right thing with the technologies that we have and move away from things that poison us to something that is sustainable and good, or better at least, than choices that would, you know, you break that atom and you can't put it back together. That's just how it is.
Well, we are going to need millions of people. I mean, as it is, we have a group of people who support President Trump because, as I have been told by several people in the last 2 weeks, that we live in a capitalistic society, and that what good is clean air and clean water if you don't have money? So, yes, they would rather have a dirty system and lots of money because we can figure out how to pay to fix it. And they will enjoy their lives, and they, you know, they feel bad about the poor people suffering, but their lives will be a lot better off. So they would rather have that.
Well, if you've ever seen that movie, the kids' movie, The Lorax, when they don't have trees anymore and they're buying their air, at a certain point you have to recognize the blessing that we really have. I'll never forget going to Jamaica. I went to Jamaica for my honeymoon, and I had this epiphany moment when I was there, and I seen how poor people were in the cities, you know, and desperate. And then you go out into the country, and there's this beautiful water is flowing, and food is falling off the trees, and you're thinking to yourself, how did we create a system that people are going hungry when 20 miles from them, food is growing on a tree?
Intentionally.
It's falling on the ground.
That is how.
Yeah, and it reminded me, and at the time I had just watched read on a National Geographic article about some Amazonian Indians that they didn't realize these guys had been migrating around in the Amazon since the 60s. They thought they had actually, you know, made this tribe extinct. And the people on the edge of the Amazon, they're starving, they're depending on tourism, so it's basically a panhandling kind of feeling when you go there. It's the same way in Jamaica, you know. And they convinced people to embrace the society that we've created, and they're all struggling, and they found this tribe that had managed to just migrate around in the Amazon and stay invisible, and they're healthy and vital and still enjoying the gift that we really have been given, which isn't money. it's the ability to find food when they need it, the honest truth for me is that you won't be able to eat your money. When it becomes time where you realize that you've destroyed the things that are really gifted to us by this planet, the clean water and the beautiful trees that create the air we breathe, you can't make up for that through this false system of money, where instead of having that gift and knowing that we've been given what we need to survive on any part of the planet we're at. When I was in Jamaica and I seen that, I thought, wow, isn't that something? In Oregon, it's the same way. You can grow your wintertime crops that are basically meant to go in soups that are warm and hot for winter. It's like we've been given the resources to have food.
But it's this whole point, though. This is the whole point. You see, we're talking about going back locally. This is one of the things that they fill us with fear. This is why that whole conversation about being scared and fear is about. There's so much fear about going back to a local system. We have been trained to believe that nuclear is not something that's an imminent danger, that it's not really harming us. Don't worry about it. People have over-exaggerated it. That we need a mega system, and that really, in order for the system to thrive, we all need to be willing to put up with a lot of toxicity. That's kind of what we're being told. So, look, Jenna, we have about 10 minutes. I really want to get to this idea about the diversity of tactics, because this is something that doesn't matter what you do. It really matters that you do something.
I agree. And I think different people are comfortable with different things. And it's like everybody in general, some people are meant to be teachers and some people are meant to be doctors, And so it's the same way with how to make a difference in your planet and how to do something good, Think about what your passion is and how you can contribute through that passion, and then it becomes something good and passionate and energy that is positive. And I think that's how you really make a difference anyway. You make a difference through creating something positive, and that's the balance towards if you become the light, you will fill up the darkness, and next thing you know, it won't be like that, and that's what I think. And so diversity of tactics was something I learned in a very big way through Occupy, honestly, because I felt like it was the practice of peace for so many different people with so many different ideas about what is the most wrong in the world and what is the best way to handle these problems. And for everybody to sit at the table and converse, the drunken person that has been sorrowful and gone through whatever brought them to live on the streets, and the lawyer that's defending civil liberties at the same table. And I think that's, and we can, the process in Occupy was to learn to respect each other's tactics, because the anarchist has this tendency of being like, I'm not going to go sit at the table and write up a proposal for my legislator and try to get a bill passed. I don't believe the system is working, you know. And then the person sitting at the table filling out, you know, the petition, or, you know, creating the petition to try to engage people, is feeling like, you know, I don't necessarily agree with what an anarchist might think is the way to, you know, revolt. So, but what you learn is that, at least what I learned, particularly with the effort to create legal places to sleep for people in our town, because, you know, people can't be productive and do something more positive with their lives if they're exhausted and they have no ability to sleep somewhere. So we felt like that was something big. And I got really involved with the unhoused stuff just because I seen people suffering when I was at that park occupying.
But this is an interesting little phrase. You know, people have moved from calling people homeless to unhoused, which is an interesting. Why is that?
Because a person that is homeless, first of all, home is where your heart is, and you don't want to, and it's got such a stigma, and it's, and just because you don't have a physical shelter doesn't mean that you want to feel like you don't have a place you can call home. And so to not have a house, to be unhoused, feels a little bit more respectful, I think, to the fact mm-hmm. that somebody might feel like where they sleep under that tree at night is their home. It may be sad
that
is what they have for a home, but that is what they consider their home. And many people are like that. And I think, and so back to diversity of tactics, you know, what we learned was it was one thing for the group of a lot of the church, the faith organizations really came through with organizing to create an official proposal to the city for Opportunity Village, a transitional small tiny house village to help people get from the street to something better. And to do that, we just were butting heads with the system, and butting heads with the system. Finally, we brought some folks in from places that do have legal places to sleep in their cities, and they said, well, we had to force the city's hand, and we put tents on the, you know, on places that were public land, and we made ourselves known, and people had to see what was really going on, which worked for us, because when people were covered with snow like that, some folks felt compassion finally, you know, instead of like fear that that unhoused person must be terrible and that's why they're there, mm-hmm. you know. And so I became really respectful of diversity of tactics, because there is a need for somebody to go out on the street to protest. There is a need for somebody to go to legislature. And there is a need for somebody, you know, occasionally. We did a lot of hardcore protesting that included breaking windows and all of those heavy-duty things to get some of the rights that we have today, for women to be able to vote, for black people to be able to not be enslaved.
It did not come without people standing up and being willing to be arrested. I mean, women were murdered in jails.
There were sacrifices made, and not every, but that's not for everybody. But we have to have the respect of knowing that I do my part over there. You do what you think is going to help the situation. This situation is a crisis. What we are facing on our planet right now, in my opinion, is a crisis. We may not recognize it as such. We may be able to ignore it and stay in our rat race survival mode, but we really do have a situation that needs all hands on deck. We need the people that are willing to be arrested, and we need, you know, the 80-year-old woman that was arrested at the nuclear power plant for putting
Sister
up a
Megan
banner
Rice.
Or
right.
something to that effect. Right. I mean, those things, all of those different ways are what it's going to take, because it's going to take all of us, and we all got to just figure out what is our niche, what is the piece that we can contribute and feel good about.
Yeah, and how can you keep doing it? We're not talking about even a one-time action is good. I'm not saying that that's not a good thing, but what I encourage people to do is figure it out because you can't wait for everyone. This is why, like, I have to say, even though I resent our National Resource Defense Fund because they've helped keep open ailing nuclear power plants, they are actually doing good in shutting down coal. And, my argument with them is that they need to see nuclear power facilities. And we need to stop the conversation of, oh, we can't do without the. That's what they said about Japan. Oh, Japan's going to lose all kinds of power. No, it's not. It didn't. But part of the reason it didn't was the coal. So that was their argument. We don't want to have to use coal. Well, we don't have to use coal. Germany went to solar within 5 years. I mean, it does not have to happen. On top of that, their coal plants are the most effective and least toxic on the planet because they invest money in, they force them to invest money here. And especially now with the Trump nation, they're just like, they're going to allow them to just decimate our country with
Oh, it's
toxicity. It's
heartbreaking.
2 years
And
from
if you
now,
go to
people are
other
going to start
places in the
saying,
world, you see how these same leaders of these industries have raped the planet, and exploited the people and violated the rules that we have put in place to make it so that we don't have to see our country be destroyed the way we've destroyed other countries. And it's almost like they've used up so much that now it's our turn to have to watch them do the same thing they've done elsewhere here. You know,
yeah.
when it comes to some of the things we've done in South America, in the way that, I mean, you see the pictures of the way they've treated the planet in places where they've taken the coal or taken the oil,
Yeah.
all the different things that we've,
The
done. It's
uranium.
really
They opened up
crazy.
uranium mining in
Uranium.
they opened up uranium mining in South America in 2012. 2015, we get the Zika virus, and they say that it's caused by mosquitoes. It's not caused by mosquitoes. The microencephaly is a direct signature of toxicity from uranium and nuclear pollution. So that,
Interesting.
the World Health Organization is the slave of the IAEA and must do what they say. And that is exact. We need to free science. And in fact, do you know if there's going to be a science protest this week here in Eugene? Do you know anything about that? We have about 2 minutes left.
I do believe that there is. I'm not directly involved with it. The
Okay,
honest truth
good.
is, I've been so busy with my radio station project, I don't know the exact dates and times for it, but yes, they definitely are doing something.
Yeah, because we do need to. I actually made a protest sign that says free science from corporations, because that's what we need. We need to free science and allow scientists to develop things without having an interest in the money. This capitalistic system, I had somebody on our show, Jill, who really did her whole thesis on the idea that capitalism thrives. It cannot happen without racism, and it is not an equitable system for the bulk of humanity, for
Well, it's
real.
based on greed.
Yeah.
Capitalism is the idea that if you are greedy and work hard enough to support that idea, that you will have the most.
Yep.
And having the
Well, like
most
my
is
client said to
best.
me, who cares how, as long as I can have a decent living, I'm sorry that other people are going to suffer, but that's what matters to me. So, look, we've been on the air with Jana Thrift from Occupy Eugene and KEPW.org, and they have a new FM radio station, which you can, in fact, find on the internet if you want to listen to their show. And they are looking for venues and topics to fill their air with if anybody wants to help out. Jana, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate all your activism.
Yeah, we're streaming online 24/7 and we're broadcasting Eugene at 97.3 FM.
Thank you. Well, you guys, put your courage feet on, take action, find your niche. Please help us save our planet. We can do it. Talk to you guys tomorrow.